T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The Fan is on your smart speaker. To listen to the home of New York sports, just say, play WFAN.
All right. 102, here on The Fan, what's happening? Tiki and Tierney show. Up until 2, it's Carter Roberts on deck. Right now we're inside, as always, the Town Fair Tire studio. Our friends at Town Fair Tire remind you that at Town Fair Tire, you always get the guaranteed lowest price on name brand tires from Connecticut to Maine. Nobody beats Town Fair Tire. Nobody. So we'll get back to these phones in a little bit. 877-337-6666. Twitter, at Tiki and Tierney. I don't know, Tiki, we probably got this book a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah, at least 2 months ago.
Right? On the national side, I know it's in the bookstores now because I know the author has posted a few pictures, and rightfully so, growing up a New York kid and a Knicks guy, and to see people send pictures of his book in these New York stores and tri-state stores has to be the thrill of a lifetime, and the book is incredible. It's called Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 90s New York Knicks. Chris Herring is the author, and Chris is with us here on The Fan. Chris, how you doing today, man?
Really good, guys. How are you?
Doing great. You know, I said something before we took our last break at the top of the hour, and I said, man, these Knicks can turn into the Warriors. They could have a modern dynasty. Not that they will, but, I mean, they could, theoretically. And we still would always have this place in our heart for the 90s Knicks, who never won anything in terms of championship. I mean, I've got my theories, and I think it's a fairly obvious answer, but I want you to tell our audience, why does this team resonate so much with you to the point you started digging and came up with these great stories in this great book?
Well, yeah, it's a team that, first of all, I've gotten so many questions from kind of, I guess you'd just say trolls, and I don't mind that they're out there, but why would we read a book about a team that never won, you know, second place and, you know, never beat Jordan? Just do a little bit of research, just even a little bit. The most watched 30 for 30 documentary is absolutely about the Fab Five. I think that there can sometimes be a natural fascination with the teams that don't quite get there, especially when we get so much in terms of documentaries, in terms of the Jordan Rules book, hagiography a lot of times about the teams that do win and the best players of all time. The Knicks had a superstar, but they did not have many stars outside of that. Mason, Starks, Oakley, one-time All-Stars. Mason wasn't even an All-Star with the Knicks. So it tells you that they were making up for something with, you know, to make up for the fact that they didn't have stars. They were incredibly scrappy. They had incredible, colorful characters on those teams. A lunatic for a coach, a complete maniac, and Pat Riley. But I think even more than that, I would say this, and I would say it with a straight face. I'm not a Knicks fan. I'm not a Bulls fan. I grew up in Chicago, actually, during those years. I'm not really a Bulls fan. But I would make the argument that the Knicks changed the way that basketball would be played and dictated far more than the Bulls ever did. The Bulls were the team of that era. No one's questioning that. But the Knicks changed the way the game would be played far more than any team in that era, because I think the league did everything it could to make sure that you never saw a repeat of this Knicks team. It changed the sport into what we have now.
Yeah, I know. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Chris?
You know what I think is really funny, because you look at guys like Oakley and those sorts of players that, you know, they swear by that era. Doc Rivers, I thought, made one of the most interesting comments to me. He was a, you know, starting point guard for the team for a year or two. And he said, you know, they absolutely brought up some of those rules and created some of those rules as anti-Knick rules. I don't care what they tell you, they brought them up and created them, you know, because they didn't like what we were doing. They didn't want us to hurt Michael Jordan. And he also said this in the next breath. He said, but, you know, thank God they did it as far as taking that stuff out and rooting that stuff out of the game, because someone was going to get hurt. And more, you know, importantly, I guess maybe not more importantly than people getting hurt, but I think just as important, the game was getting too gummed up and mucked up, and it was ugly. And you know, now maybe it's a little bit far in the other direction where you're getting 131 to 129 games and stuff like that. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that the league wanted skill to be more important than physicality. And the Knicks, because they knew they didn't have the talent that the Bulls did, were trying their best to keep the games extremely physical. Or, you know, it didn't matter if the Bulls were going to be physical, the Knicks were going to be. So they didn't have to match their physicality, but they wanted to make it physical to try to level the playing field some. And the league saw that. They saw the Pacers and the Heat and the other teams in the East trying to do the same thing, and they didn't want copycats to just make the game so ugly to where skill wasn't going to matter as much as the physical nature of what the Knicks were doing.
I mean, it was almost like football where every possession mattered. I mean, I know you were in Virginia at this point, though you know the history for sure. I mean, it was like 86, 70, not playoff games, man. Yeah. It was wild. We're talking to Chris Herring, author, Blood in the Garden. It's about the history of the 90s Knicks, and there's no right or wrong answer. It's just a guess here, but I'll throw it by you, Chris. Take Pat Riley out of the equation, who no doubt was the perfect coach for this group of players. But, you know, if it was a Rudy T, if it was a Larry Brown, if it was a Jerry Sloan or even a Phil Jackson, would this team have reached a higher level, or would they have been less, in your opinion?
You know, I honestly think they'd be less. You know, and I called Pat a lunatic. It wasn't, I guess it's hard to say that there's no criticism in that. It's just the way he was. It's just the way he's wired. And, you know, I don't think that they get any further with anybody else, really. I think Pat maybe could have gotten them further by making a slightly different decision here or there. But no, I mean, Rudy T, you looked at what he had. He had a superstar player that, frankly, was, you know, at least a little bit better. I'd say maybe even a little bit more than that, than Patrick.
Yep.
But he had a team that shot threes that was kind of ahead of its time in that regard. But guess what? The Knicks were not behind the times. I know they had an ancient kind of prehistoric way of playing defense, but John Starks led the league in three-pointers. Hubert Davis led the league in three-point percentage. It was not a team that didn't shoot from outside. They were ahead of their time in that regard. Pat was making use of analytics as a coach. He was using essentially plus-minus statistics before everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
He was having them track charges and having them track closeouts. He had them using basically a PER system to be able to track how their performance stacked up against everybody else's as far as individual players. He had them using computers and was using film to look at clutch, you know, clutch offense and look at what plays teams were running in the last 2-3 minutes of close games. So they, you know, it wasn't an issue with that. You know, I think people just assume that other things were wrong with the team or because they were trying to be so physical that they weren't good at other things. They were very skilled. They had some talent on those teams. It just wasn't the talent that the Bulls had. I mean, yeah. John Starks was bagging groceries 4 years before he was with the Knicks.
Mason.
You know, so it was that sort of thing. Mason was a guy. Mason and Starks together did not even play 3 full years of high school basketball.
Yeah.
That's what I don't think people realize about this team. The characters were just so fascinating. I think Riley leads the bunch. Mason's right behind him. And then to have Starks that has a Kurt Warner type story, you know, the only blue chipper they had was Patrick, and they almost won a title. Think about it this way. They made it to the finals immediately after Michael Jordan retired the first time, and they made it to the finals immediately after Jordan retired the second time. So it tells you a lot.
Yeah, no, it does. You know, Chris, it's what's interesting to me in this book, and it's obviously the physicality that you talk about, because you can picture it. Even if you weren't a Knicks fan, you can picture what it was like to play the Knicks. But you also bring up in this book the analytics that you were just referring to, and that's fascinating in and of itself. And cutting up film as opposed to just watching an entire game and finding situational ways to take advantage of an opponent. That's what Pat Riley was doing. But as a Chicago native and not really a Knicks fan, what drew you to this story?
I can be really honest in saying a literary agent approached me to do it. I covered the Knicks from 2012 to 2016 and was constantly, I'm only 35. I just turned 35 and I was 4 when they hired Pat Riley. So, you know, people that make the assumption, oh, you must have hated the Knicks. You know, the Knicks and the Bulls have never played in the playoffs since I was of age to actually recognize it, watch it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be honest, you know, when I lived in Chicago, I was a kid, you know, so when I guess the second three-peat, I saw just enough of it to know, like, oh, wow, you know, Michael Jordan's great, and we have him, and other teams don't. And, you know, I just thought that the Bulls parades were, like, just like the back-to-school parade, that you get every city gets these every year. So I saw that, but I didn't, you know, I didn't even register that, oh, the Knicks are big rivals. I didn't know anything about that. So I took on the book because I was asked to do it. You know, someone targeted me specifically because they figured I was young enough to not make the assumption that I knew everything about this team, that I would do the homework, that I would talk to hundreds of people to try to understand what the team was about, go back and read the 30, 40,000 LexisNexis pieces of research that I needed to piece together an eight-year period, and really understand this team inside out and get people to trust me to tell me the stories that have been buried for 25 or 30 years or have never been out there before.
Yeah.
And I hope I did that, and I think I did that.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we have you on. If you didn't do it, we wouldn't have you on.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Simple. Chris Harry.
We just kind of assumed you were a Knicks fan the way you wrote it. You know, it's just being honest, being
it's
real.
It's incredible. But that's probably the best way to do it, where you don't have a bias, so you kind of enter this with an open mind and you know, you really just react to what you're told, and you know, you obviously have your sources and you do your digging here. And I would come up with this here, Chris. I can't prove this, but to me, you know, Patrick Ewing very well just might be the most flawed superstar in the history of New York sports, because we all know he was ornery. Now, you weren't around when he was playing, but I was. I was young, but he wasn't the nicest guy. He was quiet. I'm not saying he was mean, but he was different and a little difficult with the media members, all right? His teammates respected his work ethic, but they didn't all feel him, if you know what I mean. He had some basketball flaws, missed crucial shots, had bad hands, wasn't a great passer, but yet, undeniably a superstar. And I wonder, like, what is the consensus? The guys he played with, the guys that he was around day to day, what was the ultimate scouting report on number three, on and off the court? What did you come up with?
So you hit on some of it. You know, I get into some of that in the book, that Ed Tapscott, who would later be the Knicks GM, said that Patrick had a whole lot of those double catches where he didn't really catch the ball cleanly. Don Nelson criticized his passing a little bit. He was actually trying to – he did it in, like, one of those ways where he was trying to motivate Patrick. You're so good as a jump shooter. You're an underrated defender, and, you know, you used to be a great all-time defender in college. You know, you're tough. You play through everything. Now, if we could only get you just to pass a little bit more and pass a little bit quicker out of doubles. And then Patrick said, you know, actually, I think I'm a pretty good passer already. And so they were already off on the wrong foot the first conversation they had together.
Yep.
But no, I mean, there were some critiques of him. David Halberstam, the great David Halberstam, said that Patrick maybe got so good at his jump shot and practiced it so much that it kind of maybe got to a point where he didn't focus on the other things enough, because he kind of got so enamored with the jumper that maybe after a while he didn't want to go into the post as much, that he didn't want to really work on passing out of double teams, that he just wanted to shoot that baseline jumper that he was so good at. So there was that. You know, I think the thing that really came into play for Patrick, and I get into this a little bit in his chapter late in the book, I think he struggled as he aged. I mean, he was he came into the league after 4 years of college. He had all the knee problems. He had had to carry so much on his shoulders because his number two, you know, God bless John Starks, was a relatively inconsistent player. I mean, that's kind of what he's known for, is just being really hot and cold. So Patrick had a lot of responsibility on his shoulders, didn't have much spacing within the offense outside of John. And quite frankly, was someone who, you know, wanted to keep being the number one guy. Don Nelson wanted to de-emphasize him in the offense, get the ball out of his hands a little bit more because he saw him aging. Patrick disagreed and had a problem with it. That's why you saw Don Nelson get fired midway through that season. But he was a guy that I don't think he was as beloved at the time as Starks and Oakley and Mason. Everybody that I talked to kept saying, you would almost think those three guys would have had their jerseys in the Raptors with the way that fans loved them. But all three of those guys, I mean, Oakley dove into the stands two and three times a game trying to go after a loose ball. Starks was Starks, and Mason was Mason, as far as they wore their hearts on their sleeves all the time. And I think that Patrick allowed a lot less of his emotion to show. And I think it hurt him from the standpoint of when stuff got difficult for him and when kind of that, I won't say the advent of talk radio, but the proliferation of talk radio really hindered him, because I think he heard a lot of the criticism that probably wasn't shared by everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, the phrase that Jeff Van Gundy always uses is the vocal minority of the guys that really feel strongly about everything, and that Patrick hears that And I think it, you know, after a while, especially after he shattered his wrist in 97, he wasn't quite the same guy.
I remember
and,
that.
You know, wasn't willing to take a step back, even though he wasn't the same guy.
I think that was in Milwaukee. He went up for an alley-oop. Andrew Lang, I want to say, and he wound up being a Nick later on. It was in Milwaukee when he shattered his wrist, right?
Yeah, I have that in the book about how Milwaukee was like, there's so many parallels with Milwaukee for Patrick. It happened in Milwaukee. Andrew Lang did become his teammate later. He's like a minister and, you know, always felt horrible about that, but called Patrick multiple times to apologize. And Jeff Van Gundy said, I always thought that was weird that we ended up having Andrew on our team. He's a great guy, but you also wouldn't have had him on the team had he not called to apologize to Patrick. So it tells you that Patrick forgave him, certainly, and that Andrew was a good guy to want to apologize, even though it wasn't intentional. But, no, it happened in Milwaukee, and Patrick was a guy that had the worst luck with Milwaukee sometimes. Between that injury, there's a game he played against the Bucks at one point, and Oakley, like I said, always went flying into the stands. He went flying into the stands after a loose ball one time and jumped into the crowd and landed directly on Patrick's wife in the crowd. They had to go send her back with the trainer to get checked out because Oakley's a big, muscular hulk of a guy. But then also Patrick was I guess I was about to say a bad word. He was pretty scared, pretty frightened whenever the team had to go to Milwaukee because they have an old historic kind of hotel that some people think is haunted.
I've heard of it. Patrick
had a fear of ghosts, basically, and spirits. And so his teammates would stand outside his room and make noises. Even in his coaching days, even in his assistant coaching days, Jeff's brother Stan said that they actually stopped staying at that hotel because they realized that Patrick was dead serious about the fear of going to that hotel called the Pfister in Milwaukee.
So he had
a bad run in Milwaukee. He did not have a pleasant time there.
That's a funny anecdotal story. We're looking at your Twitter account. Saw you yesterday down at the iconic independent bookstore, The Strand. They sold out of your books. They had to order more of them. How was hanging with Spike Lee? He was obviously the biggest Knick fan that there is. What was the conversation like with Spike?
I mean, we've had so many at this point. I mean, he didn't know who I was a week ago, and somebody got his book into my hands, and now it's like he wants to hang out more than my friends want to hang out with me. Couldn't be more appreciative of him wanting to make the time and wanting to get to know me better and enjoying the book so much. It's funny because, I mean, the day after he read the book the first day he got it. He read it essentially in, I guess I would say, 1.5 sittings. It was on a night where the Knicks had a game, a home game, so you know Spike was there.
Yep.
He read the book a little bit before that game, and then he finished it before he went to bed that night and called me the next morning. So we were having like a long back and forth about the book. It was incredible to have a book event with Spike Lee. You know, for me, it was just beyond. This whole week has just been so emotionally overwhelming for me just because, for the book to sell out in certain places. And, I lost my parents a few years ago, and I imagine how proud they must be, but I'm just super, super grateful for so many people to be, I know this is a lot of people's team. This is their team.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to be very careful with that legacy and for people, so many people to trust me, not just the players, but would get emails from people to say, I'm not sure I want to talk to you because why are you calling me a secretary from those years or a marketing person from those years to ask me what happened? I feel like you just might be digging up dirt. And yes, I'm interested in knowing that. I'm interested in knowing everything. And for them to trust me to tell their story 30 years later in such detail, I just couldn't be more honored that they would allow me to do that. And I'm appreciative of everybody that is enjoying the book and picking up the book.
Well, soak it in, man. And, you know, listen, I went into this hoping that it would be really good, but also with a discerning eye, like if it's not accurate or, I mean, I'm a Knick fan and it passed the test, bro. So I'm telling all my Knick fans out there, and there's a lot of them, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 90s Knicks, Chris Herring, it is really, really worth reading. Thanks a lot, buddy, and continued success. Congrats.
Yeah, good luck, Chris. Thank you, man.
Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate you.
You got it. I'll tell you this, too. I would correct Chris in this one regard. Spike is the symbolic best Knick fan. Anthony Donahue is really the best Knick fan. That's just a little thing, in my opinion. number two, and I won't reveal, I think I may have told you this off the air. I'm not going to say his name on the air. About 10 years ago, I was shooting a TV show at the Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the show on Spike TV, the Pros versus Joes?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely.
Okay. And it was, well, actually, if I divulge too much, you could probably deduce who it is, so I'll just stop there. Anyway, during shooting, during a breakage in shooting, I was in the Knick locker room, actually the old Ranger locker room, with one of the former Knicks. And he told me, because I was asking, I was just peppering him with question after question about Ewing, Starks, and everybody. So you know it wasn't Starks who told me this. And I said, that last play when John, you know, had his shot barely blocked by Hakeem in the corner, I said, what was the play out of the huddle? And he said it was a pick and roll with Pat. If you watch it, gets on YouTube. Now, Starks doesn't even really look for him. Starks' head is down, and he just zooms to the corner. And he's shooting no matter what. Come hell or high water, John Starks is shooting. But the play in the huddle was for him to do a little bit better read and then kick it back to Patrick for a foul out extended jump shot. All right? And the player told me that Patrick didn't really want to take that shot.
Mm.
That was the belief within a little... Now, I'm not saying everybody on the team, but... And years later, thing gets a little, maybe a little twisted, a little too much in the wrong direction. This guy was on the team, and he was good. And he said that he did not think that Patrick wanted to take that shot. Just saying. But we still love number 30. He left it all on the floor. Come on. Left it all on the floor. 877-337-6666. I mean, come up with another New York team that didn't win a championship that's as revered as these guys. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Get you up until 2. Then it's Carton and Roberts on The Fan.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.